But it is tonight as we approach the anniversary of another year, rather in AA, it becomes a serious proposition with all of us. It's another milestone in the history of our state group, of the state organization itself. We didn't have conventions when I first came into AA. We didn't have the wonderful get-togethers, but on the very first convention we had, it was my pleasure to meet our speaker tonight. And since that time, he has really grown, not only in my estimation, but in the hearts and minds, and truly one of the most loved men we have in AA today. One of the grandfathers, I think, and it's my pleasure at this time to introduce to you T.S.F. from North Augusta.
Colonel Foy can tell you that you won't need these things in about 5 minutes. He says the longer he talks, the louder he gets. I tried to explain to him tonight why that was so. It kind of runs in the farmer family. The gentleman told you in the beginning that we don't want any publicity so far as people's names are concerned, but as far as I'm concerned personally, you can forget about that because I'm a pest farmer, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not anonymous. I'll have to accuse my good friend Reuben for getting me into this picklement. I told a lady a few minutes ago that I was so nervous I didn't know what to do. And she said, oh, you aren't nervous. And it reminded me about a story that a member of our group has told many times in trying to explain how he felt at times about the duck. You see a duck swimming on the water and he's just skeeting along just as pretty as you ever saw in your life. But underneath there, those little old feet are just having a fit. And my legs and stomach and all those kind of things are sort of turning over now. And I'll settle down maybe in a few minutes. Reuben, who has something to do with this convention, I understand. He's promoted me. The first state convention that Bill White mentioned a minute ago that he went to in the state of Georgia, I was a coffee boy, a water boy, a janitor, and I have served in all of those capacities. And I do feel like that this is a quite a promotion. I am just delighted to be here. And I was lying down a little while trying to take a nap, and that was impossible this afternoon. And I thought about the serenity prayer. And I went through the first part, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and I stopped right there. I said, man, I can get up, go out there and get in my automobile and disappear. And I just won't have to go through all this punishment. I can just leave here, that's all. But here I am, and you put up with me. Now, those people who have heard me talk a lot of times, and I see some out here that have, I will excuse them if they literally want to leave. And I wouldn't feel bad about it at all. But for those of you who do remain, I'll try my best to tell you about what whiskey did for a person and then what happened. Since hearing all this, Shada mentioned a minute ago about the Republicans and Democrats, and naturally I I've never been interested in politics. But I have a son who is in politics in the state of South Carolina, and he's a member of the House of Representatives. He got elected on his first try. And last night we went to a rally over in Horse Creek Valley, a big barbecue supper. And I noticed the speaker that we had over there last night mentioned a little bit about America and what it needs and all those kind of things. And he did bring in the fact that something that made me think about the second step in AA. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And if they didn't need that at the Republican and Democratic convention, then I need to leave him. I mentioned a few minutes ago about a little bit about Reuben, about this promotion deal. The minute I found out he was going to be chairman of this convention and was trying to get speakers, I applied. And after talking to him two or three times about it, we kind of got the thing lined up, see, because I tell you why. My wife is his sponsor, and she's not an alcoholic. And somebody said that Reuben kind of calls me his sponsor. I said, that couldn't possibly be, because I couldn't tell that bull-headed fellow a thing in the world, but he did listen at my wife and finally got him to go to AA. So I want to thank Reuben, even though I'm still nervous, and I didn't know what to do about coming down here tonight, because one of the things that caused me to be an alcoholic, I have a lot of inadequacies, and I do not believe that I am adequate to present to you as well as somebody else might be able to present to you the alcoholic story. However, I'm going to do the best I can. I came from a small town up in Georgia, and I didn't drink any whiskey until I was away from home and at work. I left home when I was just before my 18th birthday, and I never had any whiskey to drink before that time. I didn't know what whiskey was, because there's no whiskey in our family. My father didn't drink, and consequently, we didn't know anything about whiskey. I had heard things about some of my wife's brothers and things like that, but that's as far as it ever went. I went to Augusta, Georgia, and I don't know how long a time passed by before I took my first drink. I can't say that. I don't remember exactly. But I had a date one night. This man had a date, and I was talking to him about it. I didn't know any girls. I hadn't met many girls in Augusta. And I had a double date, and we went out and drank some homebrew, and I got sick. And I didn't know how much to drink or what. I drank it like iced tea, and, of course, I drank too much. And it didn't take long for it to come back, because I figured my system was out of condition, and that was it. But that was my first taste of anything at all in the way of alcohol. And then, as time went along, though, I did just like a lot of people I hear say. I started off drinking for the same particular reason that other people do, that other boys do at least. Just devilish. I thought it was probably a thing to do to take a drink, and it didn't have any effect on me particularly. I had no craving for it, and I went on for years like that. To make that story shorter, I just graduated along drinking until I didn't think anything about it. Whiskey never bothered me. I never thought about it as an evil, and one time I remember that my father, I had never known him to take a drink. I'd heard that he might take a drink at Christmas or something like that. So he came up to visit Augusta one time, and I took him down to see a man on some business. And when we got to this man's place, he said, would you all like to have a drink? And I looked at Papa. Papa looked at me, and he said, I don't care if I do. And the man pulled out a drink, and Papa took it, and I took a drink with him, and we all three took a drink. So that was to show you I had no feeling that there was any evil in taking a drink. But that didn't take too many years of that kind of thing until finally I started to go into dances and taking a few more drinks and graduated like that. I didn't start off as a heavy drinker. But as the time progressed and I drank more, then I found out I had a capacity for it. I got over that sickness and I learned probably how to drink some. And I still never had any trouble through my early years. And when I married my wife, I didn't marry till I was 27. And when I got married, she had never smelled whiskey on my breath. However, I can remember back now that even during those times that I would have a date with her and go home about 11 o'clock and stop at a restaurant downtown in Augusta, and this man had ran the restaurant, and I would drink about a pint before I went home. Well, I would say drink half of it, and he'd drink half of it, and we'd eat a sandwich, and I'd go on home. And I thought nothing about that. I believe, though, that all along that line, the fact that I could drink, it became progressive, unbeknownst to me. I could drink more, and it took more. And I didn't show it, and it didn't have too much effect upon me. It certainly didn't have any physical effect at that time. I never had any trouble getting to work and all those kind of things. I never had the jitters. Never had gotten into that point of ever having being nervous from drinking whiskey. But as I rocked along over the years, it got worse. After we got married, my wife's mother and father were both sickly people. And I moved in the house with them. I have a fine wife. And I did think, though, that along as we went along there, I had made a terrible mistake by moving in the house with my in-laws. And their disposition and my disposition and my rearing and being away from home since I was 18 and boarding for 9 years and in a private room by myself, then I had created little things that I didn't like for them to interfere with. And I was probably more or less I had some bachelor traits. And I didn't want to be asked too many questions about where I'd been, what I was doing, and all those kind of things. After a year or two, she became pregnant with our first child, and I was transferred to Jacksonville, Florida, with a finance company. And I had been drinking some along, but never to excess, I'd say. I went down to Jacksonville, and I was nervous and displeased with being down there to start with. She couldn't go with me because at that time her mother and father both were in worse condition. And to relieve the tension and to have some personal satisfaction out of being down there by myself, every afternoon when I got off from work, I would go by a whiskey store and maybe buy about a pint. I know it. I might have started off with a half. I doubt that. But I drank about a pint every afternoon. And that never bothered me the whole time I was in Jacksonville. But that was building up in me all the time a tolerance for whiskey, which later took a great toll. And I stayed in Jacksonville about 7 months, and I came home about 2 months before our first child was born. Her mother was a total invalid for about 25 years. Her father died in the meantime. And we continued to live with her mother, or vice versa. As I changed jobs and left Jacksonville and came back to Augusta and started to work for a company out of Atlanta, I was on the road for a good many years. This job I'd gotten from out of Atlanta was a good job, and I had an unlimited expense account to speak of. They never got after me about spending money, but I'd skip a lot of meals and buy a lot of liquor. I drank with all the dealers, and I drank in every town that I went to, and I drank more and more and more. I'd be in one town tonight and another town tomorrow night and another town the next night. And each one of those places, naturally, I had to entertain a little and meet up with some different people every night, and they didn't know how much I'd drunk the night before and didn't care. So that thing got to be a little rat race. Then I went back to Augusta. I was taken off the road and made manager of one of the branches that this company owned in Augusta. And I was there for several years. And after drinking so much every night on the road, when I found myself confined to the managership of a store or a company establishment, it was a little bit too rough on me. So I started drinking in the daytime because I'd get so nervous I couldn't finish reading all the mail they sent. And I'd slip around on Broad or go to some little bootleg joint or some little bar room off on a unpopulated street, maybe around the corner, and take a drink. And then I'd have to have more. And that started to doing doing me up real bad. I stayed with that company, and I did a good job for them, I think. But I got reprimanded toward the end, and I finally lost that job. They asked me to resign. And I went from there to Macon, Georgia, and went to with the government over at Warner Robins. And if any of you in here might have worked at Warner Robins, you probably, some of you in here did. That was a rat race and a mess, and I just slopped it up over there. I drank whenever I could get it. I got in a terrible condition. I think I reached my lowest ebb in life in Macon. And even when I wasn't drinking, I realized that I was in a terrible condition. I left Macon and came back to Augusta. And I had a good job right to start with. I left Macon for a good job back in Augusta. And I got back home. And I tried to straighten out. And I couldn't do it. And I kept drinking. And it got to be slightly periodic because I wouldn't tell anybody, and I don't believe anybody in here, even though you all might be alcoholics, that sometime you have to come up there. And I didn't stay drunk every day of the world. I wasn't drunk every day or every night. But the biggest portion of the time I was under the influence of liquor, and certainly every night I was fairly well intoxicated. This thing rocked along until I began to have blackouts and do all of the crazy things that alcoholics do. I've been told before I came down here tonight by friends of mine who know that I never have talked to the convention before in my life, and they've all got a lot of advice about telling you what to tell them. Well, I can't start that either. If I start telling you all of those things, I never would get finished up. We'd be right here in the morning. But I got drunk and I got tired of what Hitler was doing over in Europe, and I got a bunch of fellas together that would help pay for the telephone call, so we called him up. I laid all my blaming, I blamed all my drinking on my wife and her people. Her mother was sick and invalid. And, of course, every time I'd go home and whiskey on my breath, she'd remind me of the fact that this was her house, and she'd invite me out. And I'd leave, and I'd stay 2 or 3 weeks and sometimes 2 or 3 months. And that was bad. And I got tired of that, and I got kind of mean along with it. And I decided those people were trying to tend to my business and they were going to ruin my life. I was drinking too much. I knew it. But they were the cause of it. So I proceeded to just break up housekeeping. And when I broke up, I mean I broke it up. I moved out and stayed a little bit, but I knew that my wife was working and that I found an occasion when her mother, even though she was an invalid, she was on a visit. She went over to see some of her people to stay a day or two in Augusta because my wife couldn't manage the whole thing by herself right at that time. And I called up a moving company, and I said, they've got all my things in that house, and I ought to get them. And I even went to a lawyer and talked to him about it, and this was a good old man, and why he told me this, I can't say. However, he was looking out for South Carolina residents, and he thought that he better tell me what the law was. He said, as long as they have it in their possession, you can't get a stick of it. So that fixed it. I called up a moving van company and told them to have two of the biggest vans they had to be at my house at 2 o'clock because my wife didn't get off till 5. And my mother-in-law was off on a visit. So we loaded up every stick of furniture in the house, and I thought I'd be cute. And I got some newspapers and put them in the middle of the floor, and I went around all the dresser drawers and got out all of her panties, all of her brassieres, all of her girdles and everything, and all of her clothes I could find. I stacked them up on that newspaper, and I took everything out of the house, including the pictures and the rugs. Didn't leave a thing, nothing. And we lived in an 11-room house. I got every stick of furniture out of the house and moved it over in Augusta, and I put it under an assumed name. I didn't use my name. I had the man to store it. Storage ate it up. Never did get any of it back. That kind of thing and worse went on with me for several years. I tried to figure back how long I drank and how heavy I drank and how much I drank. And I can't say, I really am a piker when it comes down to telling about how much of whiskey I drank. I decided I'm a piker because I was telling about drinking a fifth a day for 7 years. That I know. And I went to a meeting in Greenwood, South Carolina. And I heard a man say, drink a fifth every morning before breakfast. I said, I'll never tell that story again about drinking a fifth a day. I lost out at everything that I was doing, and I knew people didn't have any confidence in me. Now, in the meantime, all during that period that I was with this company, I got locked up a lot of times. The police got where I thought they would just pick me up whether I was drinking up on the wall, whether I was drinking or not. I went into a whiskey store one day to collect a bill from a man in there, and when I went back out to get my car, the cop said, you can't drive that car. You can't drive under the influence. I said, I'm not under the influence. He said, you certainly are. You don't go in a liquor store Pierce Farm without drinking. I know that. So he carried me around, really. I had many brushes with police and being locked up in Augusta. And, of course, I got locked up everywhere I went in those days. I went to Spartanburg to a baseball game. I got locked up at the ball game in the stands because there was a preacher and his wife sitting right behind me, and they made a little complaint about this fuss and all these folks were making down front. And the first thing I knew, a policeman weighed about 300 pounds, had my arm up my back like that, and he like to broke my arm because I objected to him taking me out of the ballpark. One thing, everywhere I went, I got locked up. I went back to Macon on a visit, got locked up over there. Used to lose my automobile. I've gotten up many mornings and trying to decide if I came home in my car, where the car was. If I saw the car, I knew everything was all right. Even though I didn't have much money in those days, I lost more false teeth than anybody. If I didn't lose them, I threw them away. I got disgusted one night trying to eat a hot dog or something, and something got under one of them, and I was riding across the river bridge, and I just reached up and got them and flung them out the window. Just all kinds of things. Lost them in the icebox one time. They froze, and my wife called me up and told me she had them. And I said, well, fine, I'll run right home and get them because I was gumming it. And so when I got home, she said, no use to worry about them. Said, I made a mistake. I said, what happened? She said, I turned the hot water on them, and they came off just like crack corn, just fell all out of it. All the teeth came off the plate. So I just had trouble everywhere in the world. Everything in the world I did, I had a lot of trouble with it. I hadn't been drinking one time in about 3 months. I know it must have been 3 months. My wife said it was 3 weeks, but I believe it was 3 months. And I had bought a suit of clothes. I bought a new suit and a new hat and a Stetson hat. I never forget that. Probably one of the only Stetsons I ever had. And I had been sober. This, I think, will qualify me as an alcoholic, regardless of what I tell you about this other thing. I hadn't had a drink for a while, and I was a good boy, and I was living back at home, and they appreciated me, and everything was doing along fine, and even my wife suggested that I might go to a picture show and relax. So I did. I got dressed up, and I had a light gray suit and a new hat and everything and shoes, and I got dressed, and I went to Augusta, and I came in through North Augusta. I live in North Augusta, so I came down to 13th Street. Down 13th Street and turned to go down Broad. And I rationalized that if I stopped at the White Elephant and got a half a pint, that it would be no trouble at all to anybody, and it would help me enjoy the picture. So literally, I stopped at the White Elephant, and I bought a half a pint, and I took a drink. Well, I went on down Broad, and I passed by the Miller Theater, the Majeska Theater, the Imperial Theater. And I don't know what was telling me these things, except what was in that bottle, I guess, the best place to park would be on down around the 500 block, which is two or three more blocks on down the street. So I drove down there. And I went into a place that I never had visited before, one of the roughest places on Broad Street. I had been in there in my drinking days, but I didn't patronize it. I went in there, and I don't know anything more than that. The next day, I waked up. And I was on the back seat of the car, doubled up with my Stetson hat for a pillow. I had wadded it right up in a knot and had it under my head, and the glass on my side was down, and it had stormed that night, and I was just as wet as a rat. And I waked up and shook my head. I said, where in the world am I? And we were on the grass, completely off the highway, on a wide shoulder. And I looked over in the front seat, and there was a man in the front seat curled up in the same shape I was in. And I punched him, and I never had seen the man before. And when I punched him, and he finally raised up and looked back at me in the back seat, he said, hi, Freddy. Well, right off the bat, my first impulse was to, I said, Freddy, hell, who are you? And I said, what are you calling me Freddy for? He said, that's what you told me your name was last night. He said, I met you in that liquor store, and I happened to make the statement that I wanted to go to Columbia to see my sister. And I said, where are we now? He said, we're about 4 miles from Columbia. And I said, 4 miles from Columbia? I couldn't believe myself. I just couldn't believe it. And he said, we're just about 4 miles out of Columbia. I said, well, let's start up here. Let's go. Let's go on into Columbia and take you where you're going. I'm going to Augusta. I got to go home, even as bad as I felt. And he said, I don't know where the keys are. I said, well, have you had the keys? He said, yeah, I threw them out the car to keep you from driving. Well, I was mad enough to kill him about it. But I sat there a minute or two and I thought, and I had to rationalize the position we were in and what he could have done about throwing the keys out of the car. So I figured if he threw them, they went out some 30 or 40 feet from the car, not too far, and I got out in the browse and I found the keys. Just exactly the position that he would have thrown them out that window. I found the keys. And I went back and put them in the car and turned them on and didn't get a sound at all. And he said, I don't think you're going to get the car started. He said, I'm going to tell you the truth. He said, last night, he said, I didn't want you to drive the car. And I got the keys out. And he said, then I decided that I wanted some music. And that car wouldn't play the radio without you turning on the switch. So he said, I pulled the wires loose up under there till I kept putting two together until I finally got music and I just tied them in a knot. The battery was down, and all my wires, 400 wires up under that thing, were torn out. All the wires were stripped loose. Went on to Columbia, got pulled in, went to Columbia and put my car in the Chevrolet place in Columbia. By the way, I was driving a LaSalle automobile, kind of like a Cadillac, you know, and it was a nice automobile, real nice car. I was so proud of it. I'd been sober for a while. Got me a real nice war car right after the war. This man had put this car up and had it covered up with a sheet all during the war because he couldn't buy tires for it. And I finally talked him out of it and bought it. Nice car. And this boy had literally about ruined it. Anyway, I took it to the Chevrolet place. They didn't have a place in Columbia like that. We were in Columbia. And I started to... We went down the road about 4 miles and found the garage man. And he tied the wires back together enough to get the car to actually run on about 3 or 4 cylinders. And we drove it into Columbia. I did. I was getting madder and madder with him all the time. He didn't know what I had in my mind, but I was going to work on him after a while. So I drove on into Columbia. And in changing the gears, I noticed that the hand shift didn't work like it ought to. And he had actually stripped some of those gears in that car. And when we got into Columbia, going straight in, there's 15 or 20 railroad tracks out there on that street that you go in on number one. And when I got right straddled on one of those railroad tracks, that gearbox locked down in the car, and the car just stopped dead still right on the railroad track, and the train was coming within about 50 or 75 feet from us. It wasn't going fast because the brakeman was already out, and he was flagging, and he hollered and told me, get that thing out of the way. And I said, I can't move it. So he ran on down to me and flagged the man and had the engine stop, the engine standing there puffing, and I was in such a shape I didn't know what to do. I was nervous, I was mad, I was scared, and everything in the world, the whole world came down on me because I hadn't been so bad to start with. Went to the picture show. All that kind of thing staring me in the face. and of all the irony you ever saw. I looked around on the street, and it was down kind of in Niggertown on this edge of Columbia. And I looked around, and there's a hot dog stand over there. And the name of this store, the name of this joint, is Dog House. And I just left that trainman standing there, the car on the track, the train parked, and I said, that's the place for me. I said that out loud. I said, Cap, you can have the car. You can take that bum in there with you. Anything you want to. I'm going to the doghouse. So I walked over there and went in the place and bought a beer. And I asked him what they had to eat, if they had anything like eggs and bacon. He said, no, got nothing but hamburgers. Well, you know, trying to eat an onion and hamburger is bad enough sometime. But at breakfast, after you've been plumb drunk all night long with about so many drinks till you don't know where you were, it's bad business. And I tried my best to eat the hamburger. And this brakeman standing in the front door cussing me out of time, threatening to call the police. So in the meantime, the man in the little hot dog stand had called the Chevrolet place, and they sent a wrecker down there and had to do something to that car. Finally, they drug it off with the wheels dragging on the back and got it over those tracks and got it on up there. And I had to wait around for them to fix the car. Well, all day that day, I was getting a little bit in condition to where I was going to really get on this boy or this man. We went to the Chevrolet place. They got a big nice place. And went in the living room, went in the wash rack, back in the back where the men changed the clothes, washed our face and hands. I went to the barber shop and got a shave and got my hair combed. And, of course, my clothes were wet, and I stood around heaters and things like that enough to get my suit kind of dry. My hat was ruined. And I got thinking about that more, and I went out on the street and bought another pint. I had a few dollars. I don't know how much I had now, but just some $3 or $4. But when I left home, I must have had 25 or 30 maybe in my pocket. I don't remember that even. But I certainly didn't have any business in Columbia, and I didn't have enough money to buy gas to go back home or do any work on my car. And he told me already how much it would cost, so I wired home for the money, and they wired it back to me. And I don't know what happened to that money that I got the first time, because by night or by the next morning, and I don't remember where I spent the first night, but I had to stay in Columbia over the next day. And the next day, the boy had disappeared. I had gotten after him in that wash rack. In there, every time we wanted to drink, we'd get out of the showroom floor and go right in the garage part, and I would take another drink, and I'd get a little warmed up with him, see, about that car. And he kind of thought I was going to get on him after a while after I got enough drinks in me. And he disappeared. I never have seen him since. I believe I saw him about a year or two ago, but he didn't recognize me as Freddie, and I didn't bring it up. I stayed in Columbia and got too drunk to drive, and I found a policeman on the street. This is the second day now, and I had lost that first money, and I had to wire for another $35 to get my car out the shop. Well, I got the second money, and I didn't want to lose it. And I paid for my car, and it didn't have enough money left, and I was too bad a shape to go to home. I couldn't possibly drive from Columbia to Augusta. So I went to a policeman on the street, and I told him what kind of condition I was in. And he said, well, you don't look like it. Because I could always stand up fat and straight and talk. And he said, you don't look like you that bad a shape. And I said, well, I am, and I want to stay somewhere tonight over here. And I got to stay on the nut, too, because I haven't got any more money. I paid my car, but I haven't got any money. I bought another pint of liquor or something with it. And he saw two boys in a little car. Just to show you how people really look out for drunks. This policeman called these two boys, and they were home from the Navy. I don't know anything about them. They never had seen me before. And they said, come on, we'll take you and get you a room. And they took me to the hotel, paid the hotel bill, got a tin bucket out of this old automobile, went by the ice house and got some ice. And I told the man I didn't want to drink any more liquor. But he said, you're going to be in bad shape tonight in the morning. You need some drinks. And I said, well, just beer, because I don't drink beer, and I know I won't drink much beer. So they got me about 3 bottles of beer, put it in the bucket, carried the bucket up and set the bucket in the room. And I sipped on that 3 bottles of beer all night and dried my clothes by the gas heater, by this steam heater. And I got up the next morning and made my way to Augusta. Now, let me tell you, I come by my house going to Augusta because I have to come through where I live. I passed right by my house, and I didn't even slow up. I went on into Augusta, and I went to the worst section of the city, the worst place it could possibly be. I went in the rear of the New York restaurant on 13th Street, which is Little Chinatown. I parked that car, and I went in that old restaurant and bought some whiskey and sat down and got drunk. I got up out of there, and a man found me in the back of a watermelon produce truck full of straw, and he found me in there about 1 o'clock that night. I had come by my house that afternoon and gone on into Augusta and gotten drunk again. Couldn't face it. I couldn't possibly go home in that condition. But I got in worse condition. And in that straw, I lost my teeth again. And about 2 weeks later, the man was unloading the straw to haul something else, and he had remembered that there was a drunk in his car. And he asked the man in this old restaurant if he knew who the man was that slept in the straw about 2 weeks ago, and he said, I believe it was Fails Farmer. The man, and he's wearing old dirt overalls and fooling around with all kind of produce and stuff like that, and he hauled those teeth all over Florida and everywhere else. And one day, he saw me and whistled at me. He said, look here, wait a minute, I got something for you. I said, what is that? I had new teeth made. And I stopped, and he said, are these yours? And I looked at them, and they were mine. I had time with teeth. One time, I had all kinds of drunks, you know. All drunks have all kinds. Laughing, crying, melancholy, loving drunks. Just any kind of drunk, you always have something different. And I've got a terrific imagination anyway, so I'd imagine I was all kind of people, you know, all kind of things. But I got on a melancholy drunk. And you know, we have a levee in Augusta. And this levee protects the entire city from high water. But I got on top of that levee and drove 13 miles down the top of the levee and decided that I'd better turn around and go back. So I was going to turn around by sight. I mean, I was just going to turn around by instinct. Every now and then, there's only one lane, too, one way to go. You just go one way. But every now and then, about a mile apart or half a mile apart, they got a wide goose egg where two wagons can meet each other or two cars can pass. Just a wide spot like a football about every half a mile. And I got to one of those wide spots, and I decided I'd turn around and come back. So I backed up once or twice in the wreck, and I just eased off too far. And I went off backwards off of the levee. And at that point, it's about 40 feet from there down to the level ground. And it is in the worst swamp that you ever saw in your life. I just went right straight off of that backwards. Well, it was cold weather. And I, like I say, was having one of those melancholy drunks, and nobody loved me at all except my big bulldog. And I had was riding him around and just having one conversation with him right after another. And he and I were in that swamp, backed off there, and the car standing up back in that position. And in that swamp, there's a silt that has been formed now by floods and other things and these washing plants that wash sand and this old silt that goes in there. And it was about 4 feet deep in silt. I stepped out of the car and put one leg down, and I went up to my waist. Well, I knew I couldn't stand up in it, so I left one of my boots in it, and I finally had to dig that boot out, and that dog was having a fit at that time. He's a bulldog, and he was just excited over that whole thing. But I got my boot out, and I didn't have any whiskey left except about one little drink. I took the drink, threw the bottle out the car, and he and I slept on the back seat all night long to keep each other warm. If it hadn't been for the dog, I believe I would have died, and if it hadn't been for me, I believe the dog would have caught pneumonia. But I had just one experience right after another like that. I got out of there the next morning, got some mules and teams, and walked up that bank, finally got some niggers to pull me out with enough mules and chains hooked to that car to drag that car up on that levee. I finally kept fooling around like that until I went into business for myself. Now, if you imagine an alcoholic that had gotten as in bad a condition as I was in going to work for himself, I had gotten a little taste of making a few dollars and still drinking because I opened up a filling station in Augusta, the only thing I could do. I leased an old place that actually was not a filling station. It had been one long years ago. They'd taken the tanks all down, but the tanks were still in the ground. And I talked a man into the notion of putting it in there. And I have a little bit of promotion ability. I believe I have. And so I put new tanks there, and I towed her into the building down with one or two little cheap niggas that I could pick up. And I got in the filling station business, and I went around to see people who had known me back in the years that didn't know about my alcoholism, but they knew that I had had respectable jobs and I had worked, and they thought I was a fairly intelligent person. And I talked to the Firestone man, and he said, I'll arrange for you to get some tires. And that was a black market deal. You couldn't buy a tire anywhere. Nobody could buy tires. I got a carload of tires. I found out that the telephone company was taking inventory, and on a 600 and a 650-16 that fitted near about all the automobiles, they had hundreds of them that they were going to turn in to replace them with new ones to keep them carrying inventory, and I got every last one of them, and I hid them. Well, in about 2 months, I just made $1,000 a week there, just selling. I'd take off a set of tiles, and I got a little taste of making a few dollars. In the meantime, my wife had read or heard some men talking about the concrete block business. And there was not a concrete block plant in Augusta, and I'd never seen one, never heard of one. Knew nothing about the construction business whatsoever. But she mentioned about this thing, and we looked into it, and we went into block business. I did. Pulling one or two little strings, and we opened up a little place in a mud hole over there in South Carolina. Today we have a real nice plant. But during that time, the place that we rented had formerly been a brickyard, not red brick, but white brick. This man made concrete brick in this plant. And they had one building in the center of the place with a pulley and chains that ran. The thing was about three stories high up in the top of it. Up in the tip top of that tower, they had a 10-inch board stretched from one side to the other to hold up somebody changing light bulbs or anything like that, and a ladder that went up to it. Well, I tried to get away from everything sometime. I'd try to hide and sleep out in the pine thicket and do all that kind of thing. So this particular night, I was drinking, and I don't know what in the world got into me. I just probably took a notion. Now, of course, I wouldn't know myself. Nobody else would know why I was determined to get completely lost away from everybody and so nobody would see me. I drove down to the plant, went inside, and climbed that ladder and slept all night long on that 10-inch board about 45 feet straight up in the air. And I had on a leather jacket and old riding breeches. And if I had just turned one time during the night, I would have landed in a mixer or a concrete floor about 45 feet below me. Stayed on that board. I waked up the next morning, still right on that board. Just so many things took place. So many things I could not account for. I went to institutions, I believe, maybe 9 times. But on my 8th trip, I found out that all of the trips that I had made had probably done me some good. I never will forget the first time I was confined. I came home, I was powerful humiliated. I had lost my privilege to drink, and I felt that way about it. I could no longer drink with the friends that I had before. And I had done so many things, and besides stealing this furniture, these are the mild things I've told you tonight, because I don't think there's any use to try to be too dramatic about a drunken career. But I tried my best to kill my wife on several occasions, run out of the house with a butcher knife and other things, and she had grounds for divorce. I even told a lawyer that she hired that he better drop that case because I might get the knife after him. She had a time trying to get lawyers to get a divorce from me, and she couldn't do it, literally, because I knew all of them, and I went and talked to them, and after I talked to them, they were convinced that it wasn't all my fault. And I wouldn't go to them drinking. I went to them when I was sober. But we got in this block business, and I had a rough and rugged road. That is the miracle of my sobriety, the complete miracle of my sobriety. When we went in this little business down there, we were broke to start with. But we started to doing fairly good, and we started doing fairly good better, and it worked out fine. We were selling everything we could make, and we started to getting production picked up, and we changed machinery, and we did this, and we did that. Things got better. And I would slip around through the block pile, and I had whiskey hid in all those blocks. You know, you turn them down edgeways this way, and they got holes in them. And I had bottles in there, and I'd be down at the plant 30 minutes, and I'd be just getting along fine. And about 2 hours' time, I'd be so drunk till I couldn't walk across the lot. And my wife would be down there with us, and she said, "I can't understand where in the world he's getting the whiskey from." And I was just checking these blocks. I was just checking piles of blocks all around everywhere like that, and I'd reach out and get one and stick it back in the hole and go right on. And she couldn't figure that out because we had a bootlegger that lived right next door to the block plant. And I just marched down to his house, go through the backyard, and come out back around the block pile with another half a pint and stick it right in the block. But things got so bad, I went into a nigger house. I hid my automobile, and I went into a nigger house. And I stayed in that nigger house for about 3 weeks. And I must have drunk a half a gallon a day. And I didn't eat anything except beef broth that this old nigger woman thought a lot of me. She finally lost her mind. But that she thought a lot of me, and she lived right close to the block plant. Nobody that worked for us, or my brothers, or anybody, kin folks, or my wife, anybody else, didn't ever one time stop to think that in the closest house to the plant is where I was. This nigger woman put me in one of her rooms, she and her husband in the other one, and I could lie down or stay there or get up, and she'd go out and get the liquor for me. And I stayed there about 3 weeks until I had gangrene, and my lips busted open, and I could just take a piece of meat off my lips and just thump it like shelling corn. I couldn't swallow, and I had been eating nothing in the world but a little beef broth that she'd fixed for me. And I drank just enough to pass out every time. I'd just drink a big gulp, and then I'd go lie back on the bed. And during that whole time, I don't actually think that I pulled my clothes off. I never did take my clothes off. And they found me, though, when I got out of there, and I was in such condition, I finally came out. And every day I would look out through a little glass on her front door, and I could see the plant and see the people, but I never did go out. And I was about dead. I was plumb rotted. And I went to Columbia to a rest home in Columbia. And when I got over there, I talked to this doctor, and he talked to me a lot about alcoholism and about what could be done for it and whatnot. He mentioned a little bit about AA, but I was in too fogged up to understand all the things he told me. In fact, he didn't tell me too much about it anyway. Because I found out later that he just loved for you to come back. You know, they send you these greeting cards. Say, we haven't seen you in about 3 months. All that kind of stuff. So I found that out, and it didn't make much impression. But my impression was that I went home and that I was powerfully humiliated. Literally, to myself, I was. I don't know that I was so humble, but I was humiliated at least. Because I didn't want people who knew me, that knew how much I could drink and all those kind of things, you know, and how well I could handle my liquor, that I had to go to a rest home. But I was nearly dead. And when I came back home, I made up my mind I was going to open up a rest home, and I was going to try to help people who drank whiskey. And that lasted for about 3 weeks until I got to feeling better, and then I probably got drunk again. But anyway, I went over to rest homes back and forth. I got rest home itis, you know. I even got so to liking them so well until I wouldn't drink before I got there. Packed my bag, got in the car, drive over, park in the back, knew right where to put the car, pick up my suitcase, walk inside, and I'd say, Agnes, I want to check in. I'm going to drink a little this week. And I'd stay there for a week or two and drink. And that's stinking. You know, that's crazy. Then finally I waked up one day and I decided that I was a nut. I mean, this was a terrible thing. And I began to take a little inventory, knowing nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I made about 8 trips over there, and one day a man from Augusta was there to bring another patient and saw me sitting in the lobby. And when he started to leave, he told the man that ran the place, he said, will you please let me know when this man goes home, I want to talk to him. I went home on Sunday, he called me up, asked me where I'd been, I told him I'd been on vacation down to Florida on a fishing trip. And he had seen me in the lobby the day before. But anyway, he kidded me along, and he asked me to go to AA with him on Sunday night, and I told him no, I couldn't go. And he said, I want you to go tonight. I said, I'm too shaky. I've got pills. They gave me to take pills if I was nervous. And he said, no, I'll be over there and pick you up anyhow. I want to talk with you. So he came on over to my house on 7:30 on Sunday night. And I went to AA that night. That was probably the greatest move that I ever made in all of my life. When I went to AA that first night, I saw people at it I knew. That was a little help. But in my all AA rooms, you have little things that look to me like beatitudes. I was just ignorant enough and just fogged enough to think that maybe those little things came out of the Bible. I didn't know. You think before you drink, and but for the grace of God, and you got all kind of little things on the wall. I read those things, and I thought then that this was a good thing. It had to be real good. And, of course, I was in powerful need of something good. And I had realized that a few times in my good thinking when I could really think, which wasn't too many times. I never had a sober period long enough to ever analyze my situation. I have one thing in my favor. It is a tradition in the Farmer family, in my particular Farmer family, that they do not tolerate dishonesty. I believe my daddy would have killed me if he'd have thought I was dishonest. Not only dishonest with people, but dishonest with Pierce Farmer. Dishonest with him, dishonest with anybody. Because I told him a lot of lies in his life that he never knew about. But when the chips were down, I believed that he believed that I would tell the truth, that I would be truthful about anything. And when I say anything, I mean anything. I have that in my favor. I do believe that the combination of the families that made up me had a string somewhere in their character or their conscience or their backbone or whatever you want to call it, of little strings like steel cords and maybe a lot of little cotton cords. And maybe I did enough damage to Pierce Farmer to break all those cotton cords. But thank God the steel ones didn't break. And that's the reason that I know today that I have had what I call success in Alcoholics Anonymous. The program has been built for me. It was made for me to begin with. I am one of those people who this thing was originated for, it was designed for, and it fits me. Fits me to a T. Nothing that I have ever known has ever fitted me quite like this blanket fits me. Just exactly what I needed. And I am so thankful that that first night I went to Alcoholics Anonymous that I looked at those little things on the wall and I heard those people talk and I thought and I went home and my wife said, "How'd you like it?" And I said, "I liked it well enough to join." And she said, "Thank God for that." Well, I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and I told you tonight that the first convention was put on. I was a water boy and all of those things. And I've worked along in AA ever since that time. And of course, I think today, on certain occasions, certainly tonight, that I have as much enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous and for the program of AA and for the very, very delight to see people sober as much as it did the first night I ever went. It means that much to me. I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we hear so much said about the spiritual part of AA. I mean, you can't make it a part because spiritual part is all part. It's all the parts of AA, and I know that. I do believe those people who are successful and stay sober have to recognize what I said tonight about the second step. You have to believe in a higher power because I heard people talk about praying. And I knew no prayers except "Now lay me down to sleep" or the Lord's Prayer. I had never prayed by myself. I had never felt that I had any necessity or maybe God was a stranger to me. Then I found out that I could pray. My first prayer to God was a measly thing. I don't know what the words were. I felt so inadequate to have words to ask Him what I wanted to ask Him, and I couldn't do it. But I went through the effort. I went through the emotion of doing it. And therefore, I was believing something. And I put myself in that position. I was humble, and I know that. Anyway, things rocked along and got so much better for Pierce Farm all the way around. This family business just leveled right off, and I love my mother-in-law. I used to get drunk, and somebody would say, "How's your mother-in-law? How's the old lady getting along now?" I said, "She's paralyzed from here down, but that tongue..." Before she died, she said she thought as much of me as she did her own son. And that I had probably been... She was just crazy about me, really. And I know that. That's just a dividend you get. I mean, that probably would have happened if I had never misbehaved. But there was such a time, you know, when you didn't have a nickel and you couldn't see anything and you'd get bemeaned by your family and your wife and everybody else. And I didn't see any light, any chance in the world of ever sending kids to college and doing all these things that people love to do. Well, all my kids went to college. And I'll have to tell you this and then I'll close. I had a boy graduate at Duke University. And he was 21. And he came home and he hadn't been home from school, out of school, but just a short while before he got married. And he had a strange honeymoon. His wife didn't know what was the matter with him and nobody else. And just a few days after that, his mother and I found out that he was bleeding from the kidneys. He was passing blood through his urinal. And that was his reason for his peculiar actions on his honeymoon. And, of course, his wife had a lot of patience And she talked to his mother about it. And they didn't tell me right to start with. And he had examination. And the doctors found inside of his bladder what's called a cabbage, the head of a cancer. And he had only been married just a few weeks by that time. We put him in the University Hospital in Augusta, and I saw him every day, and I could tell within a week's time that he was getting so much worse off, and the doctor didn't give us much chance that there was any hope for him whatsoever. And I was real sad about that thing. I have grown to think about it, accept it. And we couldn't get any satisfaction at all. So I got real busy. And I found out from doctors who I know that I could talk to that had nothing to do with the case whatsoever. And they told me that they would get him away from there if they could. And I said, where would you send him? Well, this doctor friend of mine who doesn't live too far from me, he said, I tell you what, Pierce, he said, all doctors and their children, if they can, or close relatives, if they can get there, they go to Mayo's that I know of. And I would suggest that that's what you do. So I got busy, and I had all the help in the world you can expect. Couldn't expect any more. A man who had just bought a new plane and was going to Florida the next day, he said, we'll get your boy to Mayo's. And they sent him out there the next day. And his mother and I caught the train and went through Chicago and went on out to Mayo's. And we got there a day after he did. I went in and talked to the doctors there. And a doctor flew out with him and his wife and two pilots. When we got out to Mayo's, they told us that they couldn't take the examination and all of the things from the University Hospital in Augusta and make that final, but they would have to do their own examination. So they examined him, and they decided they'd have to do an exploratory operation to find out what this thing was all about. And in the meantime, I was having a rat much of a time. Alcoholism had nothing whatsoever to do with the way I was feeling, and I know that, because I'd been sober a good many years. But I want to tell you, the reason I'm telling you this little story is to show you that if you stay in AA and you adhere to the teachings of AA and you have the help of all of your friends in AA and those kind of things, you're just a stronger person. And something had to happen to me within that 15-year period that made me a better man. And I didn't know I was a better man. I didn't want to know it. I'd rather other people know it. And I'm that way tonight. But they were going to operate on him on Tuesday, and they didn't operate. And they put it off till Friday, and I couldn't understand that. And, you know, how the family's torn up about a thing. We were in Rochester, Minnesota. About 15 degrees below zero, and the snow about 2 feet deep, and I didn't understand all that. So I was just and I couldn't sleep, and I was worried, and I talked to doctors. I talked to streams of doctors, 21 doctors, 5 here and 7 there, and they have them out there in droves. And I was trying to find out all the little things that could cause these things. Why has this happened? And I wasn't condemning anybody. Thank God for that. I didn't take the attitude that why has God done this to me? I mean, I didn't think that way about it. And I just didn't know. I was seeking something. And I was seeking something that I probably already had and didn't know it. I went to in the lobby one night. They're nice enough at Mayo's if you have a family there with your sick person, regardless of how sick they are. If they want to let the nurse go, they'll let you take turns. So there were 3 of us, and we worked 8-hour shifts. His mother, his wife, and I. We had an apartment. We stayed out there till he left. Anyway, I went in the lobby one night, and I was looking on the rack over there. It has these little pamphlets like Alcoholics Anonymous has. And I picked up a little book that was written by one of our cabinet members today. And his father was a Baptist preacher, and this man came and had a lot of training and had a lot of good thoughts and wrote a beautiful book, God's Plan. And I glanced through that thing, and I read in there about God's plan for people and things in this earth. And it all came to me just as clear that this was part of God's plan. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever. There was nothing I could do except to wait and pray. So after I read it, this nervousness and jitters and anxiety that I had left me. And I went to sleep and slept all night long. And I got up the next morning and told my wife about it. And one of these doctors had told me, he said, you know, prayer is a powerful thing. And I had prayed. I had one night when I was praying, of course I was praying about my boy and about things in general. But particularly, I was trying to summarize the fact whether or not I was deserving of all of the good things that I'd already had. And it came to me that I had gotten so much since I got sober. Everything in the world had been good. Nothing had been bad. Nothing whatsoever. And I thought about all the good people back home. And we had a lot of cards. The boy got the operation over. They took everything that was wrong with him out. And this doctor told me that did part of the work. He said, I'll bet my right arm you'll never hear from it again. And that was in 1960. And he's never been sick a minute since. Well, we came home from Mayo's and back to Augusta and back to AA. And when I got back to AA, I found out that they had been having little mass prayers. The people of my group had prayed for my boy. The people from the Hill group had prayed for my boy. I'm talking about hundreds of people who knew about this thing had prayed. And, of course, I appreciate that so much, and I know that must have had a lot to do with it. Because I'm a firm believer that if you have a higher power that you understand and he understands you, that nothing whatsoever in the world is impossible. Thank you.